day once again, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of Gun on One, the podcast. It is brought to you by Patterson Square Garden. I'm Derek Gunn. Well, when you mention the word Phillies in 2021, a lot of mixed emotions come to mind. Yes, it's still early in the season, but this has been a frustrating team to watch for a lot of people. And I'm trying to sort out what this team is, what they aren't, and I couldn't think of a better person to bring in than a guy I've known for a long time. I have the utmost respect for him, and not just as a Phillies baseball writer, but as a colleague and a friend. I haven't talked to this guy, my goodness, since forever, since we learned about pandemic and COVID and social distancing and all that stuff. But I'm bringing in my guy from NBC Sports Philadelphia, Jim Salisbury. Jim, how you doing, man?
I'm doing very well. It's great to be with you. It's been a crazy world. I guess what, 15 months ago, I never knew what Zoom was, and now I'm an expert on it, and we're talking on Zoom, but it's great to be with you, and it's great to see you, D-Gun.
Thank you, brother. Likewise. Now, before we started this podcast, you and I were just catching up briefly, and, you know, you were talking about how you don't get to travel with the team. It's an NBC policy right now. It's a Phillies policy right now, not traveling with the team, but you do get to go to the stadium for home games. But you know what it's like. I'm like you. I need that up close and personal interaction with the players, with the coaches, with the front office to get a better feel for what's going on and to get better insight in a lot of ways. Because as far as I'm concerned, in Philadelphia, nobody has as good an insight on a team, especially that Phillies team, as you do. So how awkward has it been for you to cover the Phillies in 2001, vastly different from when you've ever had to cover it, other than 2020?
It's a whole new world, and it has been since I think around March 12th of 2020. Derek, I was in Port Charlotte, Florida. The Phillies were playing an exhibition game against the Tampa Bay Rays. The night before, I think Rudy Gobert, the issue with him and COVID came up, and everybody's like, oh gosh, what is next? We're watching that game down there in Port Charlotte, and a guy named Phil Gosselin is playing third base for the Phillies. He's not with the Angels, but he was playing third base for the Phillies that day. And you see him talking to the umpire in the fifth inning, and a few days later, I'm talking to him, and I said, what were you talking to the umpire about? He says, the umpire said, as soon as we finish this game, we're out of here, because everybody knew everything was going to shut down. I don't think we knew it was going to shut down for that long and that dramatically and play a 60-game season. But it's a whole new world in terms of coverage. You're probably a lot like I am. In fact, I know you're a lot like I am. We rely on talking to people, looking them in the eye, getting a feel for them, kind of finding out what makes them tick as an athlete, as a coach. And I think that helps you tell the story of that person and that team. And without that one-on-one contact, it's very difficult. Baseball writing in particular has always been a lot of access. You always are afforded a lot of time around the team. And I think that lends to better coverage. You can really tell the story and the narrative of that team on an everyday basis. Baseball writing is like an everyday serial. Every day is a new chapter where other sports don't play as frequently. So that's what makes baseball unique. So it's been a real challenge not being able to go into the clubhouse, not being able to get a feel for what guys are thinking, how they're approaching things, how they're doing. Everything is Zoom video. You might get two or three players a day. You get the manager. But it's very, very different. And especially I think it's different in a town like Philadelphia, where there's such a thirst among the fan base for information. Mm-hmm. About their teams and details about their teams. Fans crave even the smallest tidbits. It's difficult to provide those. You do the best you can, and you just kind of hope it opens up soon. Haven't been on the road, not allowed in the clubhouse. There's really no reason to go on the road. I think hopefully it loosens up here in the coming months and get back to, covering the game the way we all know it should be covered. It's been a challenge, but in some ways it's forced you to unearth some of your old reporting skills. Mm-hmm. Get on the phone, be enterprising, think of different kinds of angles, different kinds of story ideas. So in some ways like that, it's been okay to deal with, and it's been a challenge, but it can be a rewarding challenge. But like you said, you're a guy who likes to be around the ballpark, talking to guys, yep. learning about guys, asking questions, you know, getting feedback, getting insights, and that just lends itself to better coverage that you can provide the fans. So in that regard, it's been a big change. I wonder if it's ever going to be the same again. I wonder if
really,
yeah, I do, because you know you just wonder if leagues and teams and media outlets are going to say, we covered it this long for 14 or 15 months, we're going to do it this way from now on. I don't necessarily think that's better, but you know, I was reading a story in a major metropolitan newspaper recently, I'll say, and not a Philadelphia paper, but they were talking to a couple of the broadcasters who did the ball games on TV, and they were talking about how much they loved calling them from the studio and sleeping in their own bed.
No.
And not having to go on the road. I just think that's an inferior product. I think you need to be at the ballpark, need to be putting your eyes on what's happening on the field. I think you tell the story better to your viewers. But if you have these veteran broadcasters having that opinion, maybe their employer is going to say, you know what, we're going to save the money and not send you on the road. I don't think that's the case in Philadelphia. I can tell you, you know, Scott Fransky, Kevin Franson, you know, Larry Anderson, Tommy McCarthy, Ben Davis, John Kroc, Ruben Amaro, the guys that are the radio and TV eyes and ears of the team, they want to be out there with that full tapestry in front of them. But I don't know where it's going to go, but I kind of hope it comes right back to normal, because I want to get back to telling these stories the best way possible. And the best way possible is in person. You know, it's like, I'm sure you've done interviews in your career. I've done interviews in my career over the phone to write a story, and the story's pretty good. The story's always better when you do the interview in person. So I hope we can get back to doing it all in person again, D-Gun.
Yeah, Jim, I couldn't agree with you more. Hopefully we get back to some form of normalcy before this year is all said and done. But, you know, when I'm looking at this Phillies team, you know, going into the season, there were a lot of projections that had them finishing no better than fourth in the division. Right now, they're tied for second place with a sub-500 record. But I go back to early May, and they sweep the Milwaukee Brewers, who were on a roll at that time. They sweep the Brewers in a four-game series. They're two games above 500, and I'm thinking, okay, this team's starting to gel now, and they're going to make believers out of a lot of people. But before we get into specifics, give me a general perspective of what has happened to this team as we sit here right now. They are one game below sea level.
It's a crazy division. Everybody is kind of right around that 500 mark. The Phillies a game under 500, 2.5 out of first place. There's been a lot of injuries to a lot of key players up and down the division. There's been underperformance up and down the division. The Phillies really, in a lot of ways, are kind of what we thought they'd be. Coming into you mentioned a lot of people thought they'd be a fourth place team. I was one of those people. I also thought that they could be finally above 500 team. Haven't had a winning season since 2011. I thought this was the year they're going to have a winning season, and I still think that. That said, I'm talking 82, 83, 84, 85 wins, somewhere in there. I thought they could be playoff relevant if nobody runs away with it, if they get a career year or two, and they stay healthy. So I think all those possibilities are still on the table. I think in a lot of ways, they're very fortunate to be where they are. Fortunate that there's so much parity and so much underperformance in the division. Other teams are in the same boat as they are with injuries to key players. But, you know, you get to the Memorial Day weekend, which we are, and it's the first checkpoint of the season, and you're 2.5 out, a game under 500, well within striking distance in the division race. You're interesting. You've had a ton of injuries to key players. You haven't had your whole team together really at all season. I think you should be maybe fortunate to be where you are, but at the same respect, happy to be where you are. You're in it. You know, they haven't had Realmuto and Harper together barely at all this month. Both guys have battled injuries. They had a dreadful bullpen last year. They went out and made, I'd say, one marquee addition in that bullpen, at Archie Bradley. And he spent the month on the DL and is really just getting going now. You've had to overcome poor performance on offense, at least inconsistent performance on offense, especially with runners in scoring position. And if last year you dealt with the worst bullpen in the history of the game, maybe this year you're dealing with the worst defense in the game in 2021. I mean, the defense has been awful, and they haven't scored enough runs to play over that defense. So with the injuries, the inconsistency on offense, and the very, very, very poor defense. I mean, they give away outs every night. And when you do that at this level, this is the best players in the world, they seize. It's like a turnover in football. You turn over the football, you know, inside your own 50, you're going to pay for it. And that's what they do when they make errors or just don't make plays because they're not a sharp defensive team. They give away outs and the other team seizes. So all of that has gone wrong, and yet they're still right in it, a game behind, two and a half games behind the Mets, and a game under 500. I'll take it on Memorial Day weekend. I've always kind of liked the analogy of a baseball season to a NASCAR race. You know, you want to get out there, making sure you got a good car under you, and stay in that pack for the first couple of months. And let all those SOBs wreck up in front of you. And then you need to have your car in a condition, in a working order that you can kind of zoom in there when everybody wrecks and have a hot streak. And then maybe your pit boss makes a nice trade and makes your car better. And you can even zoom to the head of the pack at a later date. So I actually think if this was a NASCAR race, they're in for all the nicks and dents and bruises they've had on their car. They're okay. And you know, hats off to Joe Girardi's had some issues here, but hats off to him. He's kept things together without Bryce Harper and JT Realmuto, Archie Bradley, without a fourth and a fifth starter. And they're in it. I'll take it on Memorial Day, any day of the week. What they've been through and where they are, I'll take it.
Yeah, we can say what we want to say about this team, and you and I both agree. Going into the season, we thought they'd be an average team at best. But I also thought they had a lineup, hitting-wise, that would give a lot of opposing teams and a lot of opposing pitchers fits every night. But when you look at their stats, they're eighth or ninth in a lot of major categories offensively in hitting. But I think the most alarming stat is they're first in the league in strikeouts. I mean, undisciplined at its finest at the plate.
Well, you look at the track records and the names, and I agree with you. You think they're going to give opposing pitchers fits. Just the opposite. When you strike out and don't make contact, you become easy out. And they just don't make enough contact. There's way too many strikeouts in that lineup, and not enough damage to go with it. They stressed contact all spring long in Clearwater and have come out of the gate with not a lot of it. Bryce Harper's been banged up. His strikeout rate is up. Alec Bohm at third base has had a tough time in his second year. They haven't got a lot of production out of the position. He's racked up a lot of strikeouts. I'm just curious to see what can happen if they can all get whole and get healthy again. But there's no question that they need to cut down on the strikeouts, have a better two-strike approach. They went through the first month of the season where they had nothing at all out of center field. They're finally getting something last few weeks out of Odubel Herrera. They're going to need to score more runs, make more contact, strike out less, because I don't know that these defensive issues are going away. You're going to have to score more runs to play over your defense. You're going to have to score more runs so you don't drive your starting pitchers crazy. Their starting pitchers have been pretty good. The top three have been very good. Lately, you've been getting a nice contribution from Vince Velasquez. I think their starting staff is third in the majors in innings pitched.
Yes.
They're like fourth or fifth in the majors with 22 quality starts. I'll take that any day of the week. I'll take Zach Wheeler any day of the week. Zach Eflin, Aaron Nola. They can pitch for this, your team any day of the week. They're quality major league starters. But they're also human. And they can't walk a tightrope every time they take a mound because they have no run support, because they have no margin for error. I mean, Sandy Koufax used to hang a curveball. You can't go into a game with pitching in the back of your mind. I can't make a mistake. I can't make a mistake because I know we're only going to score three runs. We're only going to score two runs. So winning solves everything, and scoring runs also solves everything. in a lot of ways. So they need to score more runs. I think that'll take some pressure off the pitchers. It might even take some pressure off the defense. Because when you're in a tight game and you know you're a crappy defensive team, you're out there saying in the eighth and ninth inning, oh, gosh, I don't want to be the one to throw this one away tonight, you know? So if you get some room for error, some breathing room, it would help everybody.
Jim, this is a team that has 29 defensive errors in 51 games. That has to be driving Joe Girardi nuts.
I would think it is. I mean, he's not going to reveal that, but I mean, he cares. And managers really care about defense. I mean, they work on it all spring long. They work on it early in the day. At 2:30, they're out there working on it. And what happens when you have a poor-looking defensive team? I mean, the manager can't go out there and catch the ball and throw the ball.
Exactly.
But what happens when you have a poor defensive team is you look unprepared. You don't look sharp. You look sloppy. You look like you don't know what the hell that you're doing. And unfortunately, that reflects right back on the manager. So I'm sure it really grates on him. I mean, coming in, I don't think anybody thought they were going to be a good defensive team. I had a lot of conversations with people over the winter that I thought they only had one above average defensive player. Mm-hmm. And this was over the winter. And that was the catcher, JT Realmuto. And I still feel that way. I just did not think they would be this bad defensively. I thought it would be a hole. I didn't think it would be a Grand Canyon. But right now it is.
You know, there's still a lot of baseball to be played, but you can see that the frustrations have been evident. Not too long ago, you know, we saw the heated discussion between Gene Segura and Girardi in the dugout. And then recently the manager says, I am no longer sharing information with the media in terms of who's available and who's not day in and day out. We just feel this is in the best interest of the team. When it's always been a given that teams will share that kind of information, you know, with the media. Where do you think this comes from?
Well, I think it comes from just a handful of days ago when Joe admitted to not telling the truth about Bryce Harper's health. You know, instead of saying, hey, he's banged up, instead of saying, I really don't want to say anything, he flat out said he's fine, he's healthy, when he wasn't. So there's a difference between saying nothing and saying something completely false, as you know. And then the next day they admitted to it and he had to apologize for the way he handled it. And then 3 days later, he's got a new policy. He's not going to say anything about a player's availability. Sounds like he might be trying to save himself from himself. I question the strategy of pushing away interest in your ball club when you haven't had a winning season in 9 years, when the gates are just about to be fully open. When the Sixers have passed you on the sporting ladder in town, I would think you would welcome any and all interest. He's not spiting the reporters. I think he thinks he is, but I will tell you, I know this group of people who cover the team. Yep. I know guys who cover teams in all towns. We don't take it personally. I don't take it personally one iota. If Joe Girardi never answers another question, it's not going to affect my life one iota. But, you know, we're proud professionals and we take pride in informing the fans on what the hell is going on with their team. Mm-hmm. Tell me what's going on with my team. When you bump into somebody at a barbecue stand, they want to know what's happening with the Eagles. They're relying on you to tell them what's going on with their team. That's right. Pride in that. So if you can't get information, you can't tell the fans as much. Right. And that doesn't make a lot of sense to me if I was a team executive. You know, to shut off interest because, you know, they are your paying customers. Mm-hmm. They pay the bills. You would think you want to let them in on as much information as possible. I understand, totally understand the nature of having a competitive edge and not telling your rivals too many secrets. I've covered this game for a long time. Every manager I've ever covered has had that philosophy, but they've been able to manage to walk that tightrope. You have to give the other managers a little more credit than that. You don't want to tell Don Mattingly that Bryce Harper's hurt, but Bryce Harper comes out and it doesn't even have his uniform top on. Yep. The Florida Marlins, Miami Marlins are smarter than that. Some scouting and data collection and just surveillance of other teams is so sophisticated. By you clamming up, the other team, they're not gaining any upper hand here. This, to me, sounds spiteful. It sounds a little bit like he's maybe a little embarrassed that in his way of handling the previous situation with Bryce Harper. So this is his new policy, or the team's new policy, or baseball operations new policy. I'm going to guess, and these things blow over quick in mm-hmm. baseball all the time. I mean, reporters and managers, they battle all the time, and the next day it's over. You know, slap each other on your back and you move on. The Harper thing, which happened on like Monday and Tuesday, was over. It was done and gone until Joe picked at the wound yesterday and made it a bigger story than it needed to be. He totally mishandled this thing. But I'm going to say this. I think it'll blow over quickly, and eventually his policy will loosen up. And he'll be able to say, instead of, you don't have to give away family secrets, but you can say, yeah, guy's banged up a little bit, but you know what? Late in the game, he's gonna be ready to be Kirk Gibson mm-hmm. if I need him. Mm-hmm. And now you've covered your bases and you move on, and everybody's happy. I do think a little bit of this goes back to what we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
The Zoom world has really affected the ability to build relationships and gain background information from the people you cover, and it's been stressful on people, and maybe this is just kind of it all coming to a head. I think it will pass, but you know, if Joe's going to clam up for competitive strategic reasons, he thinks it's going to help them win ball games, then hey, go out and win 10 in a row. Let's see it, big mm-hmm. boy.
I picked up on something you said a few moments ago. You were talking about the top of the Phillies pitching staff and that you were fine with them. You felt they've given quality innings in a lot of ways. But when you look at the staff as a whole, they've given up a league worth 64 home runs, I believe it is. Is there any way to patch up the dam and stop the leaking in that regard? Because you're right. You look at Zach Eflin. You look at Wheeler. You look at Aaron Nola. You know, sometimes they come out there and they pitch like all-star pitchers. And then occasionally they have, like any pitcher, they have those moments where they can't find a plate, you know, and they're watching the ball sail out of the yards like we're watching 4th of July fireworks.
Well, I think that's the nature of the game. You're going to give up home runs, especially pitching this ballpark. Even the greatest pitchers on earth make mistakes over the
yes.
plate. You make a mistake over the plate, it's going to get hit hard. I think it's important to note as good as Wheeler, Eflin, and Nola have been, the top three, really a strong point of the team. You know, I don't know that any of them are Randy Johnson, Curt Schilling, John Smoltz, Kershaw, Verlander, Scherzer in their prime.
Yeah,
I think they're very, very good. But I think it's unrealistic to expect them not to have a bad game here or there, not to give up some home runs. I think Aaron Nola has been a little off this year. He's given up mm-hmm. more fly balls, probably mm-hmm. given up a higher home run rate than he would like. Eflin had that one game where he gave up a couple in Washington. Yeah. You've given up some in the bullpen. But, you know, for the most part, I would take the starting pitching. I mean,
yep.
it was kind of troubling what we were seeing in the 4 and 5 spots. But lately, Velasquez has emerged, done a pretty good job at 4. I mean, Spencer Howard has a lot of upside. He's sort of filling that number 5 spot. So in the grand scheme, I think the home runs or the starting pitching is not nearly this team's biggest flaw. That said,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think if Dave Dombrowski was probably going to address anything at the trade deadline, if they're in it, you know, you probably might look at the back end of the rotation. And I think you might look at setup relief and just getting even some more, try to get somebody locked down maybe at the end of the game. I mean, Alvarado's exciting with that arm, but he's an adventure, man. I mean,
yep.
You need 2 packs of Rolaids to watch him. Hector Neris to me is far from lockdown. So I think those are bigger issues. And the home runs are going to happen. The key to that is don't walk people in front of the home runs.
Exactly.
You know? So, yeah, we'll see.
You know, before the season began, I'm looking at scouting reports of various teams. And one thing that caught my eye is one of the scouting reports in the Phillies was Aaron Nola is not a staff ace. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, when I look back on his career, there's been times where you could argue, oh, yes, he is. I mean, he's got the stuff. But, you know, you're right. There's other times where it's you're wondering, like, okay. And I look at his numbers from this year, just the month of May alone. 1 win in his last 5 starts. He's lost his last 3 decisions. He's averaged in a month about 5.5-6 innings. But I'm looking at his pitch count, like 114, 103, 98, 97. I mean, that's not good. when you consider the volume of innings that he's given his team.
Something has seemed off on him really all season, except for that Sunday afternoon shutout at Citizens Bank Park of the St. Louis Cardinals. He's just been a little off. He's even admitted to it that his command is not as crisp as he's enjoyed in the past. And he's not a guy who's going to just power the heck out of you.
Right.
He's 100% pitcher. You know, four pitches, change speeds, battle, put those pitches in good spots. And he struggled with his pinpoint location and his command. Mm-hmm. He struggled with some of his off-speed stuff. His changeup's been hit or miss. His breaking ball's been hit or miss. You know, in past years, he has that great sinking fastball, that two-seam fastball that kind of like just kind of fades in and down to that right-handed hitter, like Zach Wheeler throws, like Zach Eflin throws. They got three guys who have good sinker balls. And Nola has thrown that less this year than in other years. I actually asked him about it. I was wondering if maybe the data was wrong or what. He admitted he wasn't throwing it as much. And he said he just hasn't had a great feel for it. I will say two nights ago he pitched in Miami. I thought he had the best breaking ball I've seen. But something's been a little amiss there. But even though it's been a little amiss, he's still pretty good. He's still very good. I would take him any day. People always, he's not an ace. I mean, what is an ace? Ace, you can look at, in the small picture, are you an ace of a team or are you an ace globally? You know, I don't think Aaron Nola is a number one starter by the pure classic definition of all those guys I mentioned before.
Yes.
You know, Randy Johnson in his prime, Schilling in his prime, Smoltz in his prime, Verlander in his prime, Scherzer in his prime. Those are number ones. Koufax. Those are guys that when you wake up that morning, you say to yourself, oh, bleep, I have to face this guy tonight. Yep. And I don't know anybody that says that about Aaron Nola. But that said, he's still an awfully good pitcher. He might not be a number one, but you know what? You can win a World Series with four number twos. Because you know what? You're going to be a pretty damn good pitcher to be a number two at this level. And, you know, the kind of way I look at it is that's kind of what they have is three kind of number twos. And maybe Zach Wheeler is starting to knock on the door of being a number one. And I think that's enough in a short series if you can get enough. A short playoff series, if you can get there, and if you can get enough help from your four and five spots, just keep you in some games. And then when the four and five guys keep you in the games, you got to score some runs for them.
Yeah.
And then you got to have a tight bullpen, and you just got to catch the ball behind these guys because poor defense, like I said, makes a manager look bad, but it also it can ruin an outstanding pitching performance in three swings of the bat.
If you were a decision maker with the Phillies. And let's say, as you just mentioned, this team is still in it at the trade deadline. What kind of moves would you make to make this a better team, offensively, defensively, pitching? What kind of moves would you make?
At this moment, and they could change. I mean, hey, a month ago, we thought they were going to need a center fielder.
Yes.
They're on center fielder number four, and Odubel Herrera is doing a pretty good job, seems to have eliminated that need. I would like somebody locked down late in that bullpen. Somebody has a nice, slow heartbeat that doesn't get all crazy and high-wired and when the game's on the line. I mean, there's a lot of tension out there. So I kind of would love a lockdown eighth or ninth inning guy that you could slide everybody down a little bit, really make that bullpen a strength. And I would look for a veteran stabilizer at the back end of that bullpen. And I hope they're not looking for a third baseman. I hope they're not looking for a veteran third baseman because Alec Bohm is struggling in the field. And or struggling at the plate. Now he seems to be taking it to the field. I know he never had the reports where he was never a gold glove defender, but I think he is better than this. I just think he's kind of in a little funk in his entire game. And I think he's going to be a good player. And I kind of I hope he turns it around in the month of June. He seems like a strong-minded kid, so I'm going to think he will. But if he doesn't, you might need to do something veteran-wise. At third base. The only problem there is you don't have a lot of trade capital. The farm system is weak, and the prospects you do have, you want to hang on to because they need to start bringing their own people to the major leagues, especially pitchers. I mean, you can't afford to have to go out and and sign a Zach Wheeler all the time and a Bryce Harper all the time, because that just kills your payroll. You need to be bringing your own young guys, impactful and affordable, to the big leagues. You can't just do business on the free agent market forever, because it's just unsustainable. So not sure what Dave Dombrowski can do or will do. He doesn't tip his hand, but I think those are some areas that he might look at, as long as the team stays in it. Yep. The way things have gone now for 2 months, I think they have every chance to stay in it, because the division is cooperating with them. And as long as nobody runs away with it, I think they can stay there. If they can get healthy and whole and just improve the defense a little, improve the offense a little bit, I think they'll become more interesting.
You know, I don't want to just sit here and browbeat the Phillies. I mean, because as I said, and I want to emphasize it again in this podcast, there is still a lot of baseball to play. They are in a division that is wide open. It's a coin flip right now. But one of the bright spots I do like about this team is that young catcher, Rafael Marchand. I like this kid. But obviously, when Real Muto gets back, he's not going to get much playing time. But when you talk about looking for players to the future, you have to build within your own system. This kid, what is he, 22 years old? I love his arm. I love his savvy behind the plate. I love everything about this kid.
He is a baseball player. He's a Venezuelan kid. He grew up as a shortstop, idolized Omar Vizquel, as every infielder from Venezuela does. The Phillies first watched him play in Latin America when he was 14 years old.
Yeah.
And they loved his instinct. They loved everything about him. He was a baseball player. But the body type didn't project as a shortstop. They were interested in signing him, and and they eventually moved him to catcher. And that happens a lot. It happened with Carlos Ruiz. It happened with JT Realmuto. He was an infielder. I mean, a lot. Jim Thome was a shortstop. Shane Victorino was a shortstop. I mean, at that age, you're always putting your best player at that position. But, yeah, this kid's got great actions. He's got great baseball IQ. He was a middle-of-the-diamond player as an infielder. He's a middle-of-the-diamond player now, and that's where you want your best players. Very good hands, very, very coachable. Picked up the catching position very quickly. They did an excellent job with him in their player development system, making him a catcher. Throws well. I mean, we saw him pick off a runner Thursday in Miami, and everybody said, wow, what a great arm. That pickoff started with the head. Started with the head when he made eye contact with Rhys Hoskins, thinking, hey, this guy's got a little wander in him over there. I might come at him. They made eye contact, and then it started with the footwork. Great footwork, delivered a strike to Hoskins, picked off Miguel Rojas, another guy from Venezuela. So I'm sure they'll probably have some fun with that if they play each other in winter ball. But yeah, he's definitely projects as a major league defensive catcher. Whether or not the bat comes along is another story. But as a backup catcher in the big leagues, it has to be defense first. And I think he can really do a good job for them as a backup guy. But at some point, you got to get him to AAA. He needs to play every day for his development. And then you're like, okay, is he going to be our guy or somebody else's guy? Because you have JT signed for 4 years after this year. He might be young enough that he can be JT's understudy for a while and then become your number one guy. But catching's a premium position. Middle infield guys are premium. I'm sorry, middle of the diamond guys are premium in baseball. And he's a good one. I think he's a feather in their cap for their player development system. They've done a good job with them. It would be nice if they had about 10 more of them, because they are just very thin in the system on position player prospects. But you're very right to like Rafael Marchand. Joe Girardi loves him. He's a good one. He's fun to watch play. He plays with his head. He's a heady, heady ball player. And that's what you need behind the plate, because he's the guy with the whole field in front of him. And, they've been compared to quarterbacks. And, I don't know if there's as much on their plate as a football quarterback, but you get the analogy. It's sort of a command center back there. He's got a very, very bright future.
How many years have you been covering pro baseball?
Oh, wow. I started covering baseball in 1988. I started covering the AAA Pawtucket Red Sox in 1988. And, I came from a baseball family. I was been cleaning out my my boyhood home. I lost my dad a couple years ago, and he actually did some scouting. I don't know if he'd want to admit me admitting to this. But he was a scout for this. He has paperwork being hired as a scout by the Seattle Pilots, who are one of the worst teams in the history of baseball. But he did some scouting in New England for them back in their one and only year in the late 60s. And I kept it all. I have it over here. And then he moved over with when they went to Milwaukee. And he worked for them 2 years when they became the Brewers. And and then he smartened up and realized that there are probably not, you know, much as he loved the game. And he did other things with his summers. He was a teacher. But scouting was a lot different back then. But, you know, I grew up in a baseball family. And, you know, my parents, we had a lot of newspapers in the house because they were teachers and we had books in the house. So it was kind of the perfect blend, a little baseball and words. And here I am, a baseball writer. So I've been doing it a long time. And you know, as much as I love the game and writing about the game, I love the people in the game. You probably say the same thing about football. You know, baseball people are just it's just great to be around the game and around baseball people. And honestly, it's been tough during this pandemic. It's can't wait till it goes away.
All right. How many years you've been covering the Phillies now?
So 94 was my first year covering the Phillies. I covered it for two years. And then I exited for a year and I went up to New York and I covered the Yankees in 1996 for the New York Post. Mm. And I was a first year guy in New York the same year as Joe Girardi was a first year guy with the Yankees. And I really enjoyed covering him, got to know him, and now I'm covering him again. It's a whole different perspective. Since 94 with the Phillies, with 1 year off to go to New York, cover the Yankees, and I came back in 97. You know, I figured the Yankees won the World Series in 96 and figured, you know, they're on their own now. So I came back to Philly, and I'll tell you what, it was it covered some really lean years at the end at Veterans Stadium, but it was – you know, I think as a reporter, and you'll agree with this, we enjoy a good story, right?
Yep.
And it was a really good big picture story watching the team come out of Veterans Stadium, come into a whole new ballpark, and bring this core of players with them and kind of get good and have that great run. So it was kind of neat to watch them sort of rise from nothing and become, you know, at one point, maybe the best team in baseball for 3, 4, 5 years. I remember people, you know, when they're back in 2029, 10, 11, when they got Halliday and Lee, people were comparing them to the Yankees. So from when they came out of Veterans Stadium and the nothingness of where they were to where they were after winning that World Series in 08 and then how good they were in 9, 10, and 11, it was what a growth. And then they tumbled off the radar screen again. And they're still trying to get back there. And, you know, I think, like I said, I think they can be playoff relevant this year, but I certainly wouldn't call them anything close to a powerhouse franchise when you look what's coming in the farm system. Just not enough, not enough. They need more. They need more. Mm.
So you've had almost 3 decades to cover this team. You've written a lot of incredible stories in your illustrious career. You've made a lot of great relationships with players, coaches, front office people. So I'm going to put you on spot a little bit. In the time that you have covered this Phillies team, give me your top 3 favorite players to cover.
Oh, gosh. Honestly, I don't know if I can give you one.
I knew I'd catch you off guard. I had to throw that in there.
You know, I'll say I liked so many of them on a personal level, and I had so much respect for so many of them as competitors and people. I mean, a guy like Jim Thome, an absolute privilege to know and to watch and to cover him. I mean, it's such a unique relationship with Ruben Amaro Jr., covering him as a player, as assistant GM, as a GM, battling with him, and now I'm a colleague of his. I loved covering Jimmy Rollins because Jimmy Rollins did exciting. He was a good guy, very smart, did exciting things on the field and said exciting things after the game eloquently. I mean, does that make sense? I guess. I loved covering Curt Schilling for the same reasons. Did exciting things on the field, said interesting, often provocative things after games. Hey, as a journalist, it was good copy. I like Billy Wagner for the same reason. But there are guys that were much more, much quieter. Doug Glanville. Doug Glanville was a fascinating guy to cover. Just one of the most compassionate, caring, smartest guys you'll ever meet. He wasn't loud and boisterous, but he was spot on with his opinions. So, I hope I'm probably missing out on a lot of people. I mean, you know, covering Darren Dalton late in his career, watching what he went through to get on the field with his knees, covering Chase Utley, watching what he went through to get on the field with his knees. It's funny, a lot of reporters just say, how come Chase never comes out and talks to us after the game? Mm. I never said that because you know why? He was packed in an iceberg. I mean, he had to, you know, ice like everything on his body just so he could play the next day. And then I remember like he'd come out and he'd have like his hip, his hip and his knee would be like, it looked like Hamburg because he would have slid into the base hard or something and ripped it up. So just so many guys that I'm sure I'm missing. You know, Mike Lieberthal was a great guy to cover, incredibly honest.
Yes, he was. Yep.
There's a lot of guys that on this team that are a lot of interesting guys and fun to cover. Rex Hudler was a great guy to cover. I mean, just an amazing character. I remember he came to Philadelphia in 97. He was here in 97 and 98. He didn't play well. He ended up getting released. And he got released in 98. And I went over to his locker and he started crying. And he looked at me. He started crying. And he looked at me. He used to call me Steak because my last name is Salisbury. That's very original. But he looked at me and goes, Steak, I got fired today. And he busted out crying. And he's like hugging me. I didn't know what to do. But, I mean, he's one of the greatest guys you'll ever meet. Charlie Manuel, Larry Boa, Francona. I mean, just great guys to cover. I mean, how could you not like Charlie Manuel's story? I mean, he came here. Nobody wanted him. They kicked him around like an old football, and now he can't buy a drink in town. He's so beloved. He gets the biggest cheers. He's like Bernie Parent. He gets the biggest cheers in town when he's out there. I mean, Larry Boa, the fight, and the Philly's icon that he is. I think they should retire the number 10 in honor of him just for his body of work as a player, manager, coach. He's done so much. So, the relationships have been. You know, Dallas Green, I mean, another one. So the relationships have been really the highlight of it all. Like I said, I love the game. I love the game within the game, the pitcher batter showdown, the catcher trying to set up the hitter. But as much as I love the game, I love the people in it. And so that's why it's been so rewarding.
Who's the one most colorful player that you've ever covered in a major league?
Oh, I go back to Jimmy and Schilling and Wagner.
No. You only get one. You can't have four or five. You get one.
Most colorful? It's probably Jimmy Rollins. Jimmy Rollins. I remember I was doing a story with him. When he became the Phillies' all-time hits leader, I sat down with him and I spent 2 weeks on this, like, because, you know, he's busy getting ready for games, so I get like 2 minutes here, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes here. But my goal was to get Jimmy's top 10 hits in his career, you know. And one of them I said, I'm including this one, Jimmy. I said, I remember your, like, I think it was your first or second big league home run. You flipped the bat on Steve Kline, who was a veteran reliever. This kid's just up from AAA and flips the bat. And he starts laughing. He remembered it. And Kline is yelling at him the whole way around the bases. But, you know, Jimmy had style. He was colorful. But, man, could he pick it. He was a great defensive ball player and a good hitter. I mean, I think about that 07 season when he had he led off that clinching game when he won the MVP.
Right.
Led off with that triple. I mean, Jimmy just had a way of rising to the occasion. He was like Lenny Dykstra, red light player when it was on. You know, I remember he hit a big home run in the playoffs out in Dodger Stadium, and the place was so quiet, and all you could hear was the people under the press box cheer, and it was Jimmy's family. So he was a very colorful guy. Jimmy could make fun of himself. I mean, he knew Charlie benched him here and there for not running, or he was late for a game in New York and one day. And he kind of would, when the dust settled on it and the furor settled down, he would make fun of himself. So I would say Jimmy was probably the most colorful, but I'm sure there's definitely a long list of other guys on that list.
Look, I know I've taken up a lot of your time. I won't take up much more, but before I wrap up this podcast, I want to talk about Jim Salisbury, not the baseball writer, but the father. And I go back to 2017, and we all received this numbing news that Jim Salisbury's daughter, Mary, had suffered a spinal stroke. And it caught us all off guard, and we were like just speechless. And here we are, and I can't even begin to imagine what you and your family were going through. But here we are almost 4 years later, and I was working with you at NBC Sports Philadelphia at the time when it happened. How's Mary doing today?
She's still recovering, and she's doing, it's like a coach tells a player, give me your best, do the best you can. And she does it every day and gives us her best and gives herself her best and is an unbelievable inspiration. We're lucky to have her, and we're grateful to have her. And she's almost 4 years out. It's life-changing for everybody, for her. In a lot of ways, her life was shattered, and she was just getting out of college and beginning her career. But almost 4 years later, she's getting closer to being able to maybe resume that career. Mm. And she's going to do great things with her life. I know that. She's got a Hall of Fame mother, first ballot, my wife. And she's got two unbelievable sisters who are there for her and always going to be there for her. But she's most importantly there for us. And so... every day is, it's not easy, but it's also, she's a great blessing. And, they have comeback player of the year in baseball. I think she's going to be comeback player of the century. I'm not sure what it is yet, but she's going to do something unbelievable with her life, and she's going to inspire a lot of people. And, she inspires me every day. So, thank you for asking about her. And she's doing okay. She's doing okay.
Well, that's good news to hear. And I like to use, when I talk about people and how much they're respected and loved, I like to use the term, a man should be judged not by the money he accumulates in his life, but by the amount of friends and respect he has in his life. And I look at when that happened, and the medical costs were projected to be astronomical. And there was a fund set up. And I look at some of the people who jumped on board and contributed to that fund. Brad Lidge, Jamie Moyer, Jason Stark, Ruben Amaro, Scott Rowland, numerous broadcasters, beat writers. I think that says a lot about Jim Salisbury, not baseball writer, but Jim Salisbury, the person, how he affects people, and how people respect and love him. Would you agree with that?
That's nice of you to say. I mean, all those folks you mentioned are, some of the greatest people on earth. She's doing okay. I mean, there were just a lot of challenges, with paralysis, that people don't even realize the daily challenges that go along with this. But man, she's just out there taking it head on and doing a great job. So, it's opened all our eyes to, she goes to McGee Rehab and, great, unbelievable people down there. And, every day, Derek, people coming through those doors in wheelchairs and who've had spinal cord injuries like Mary and other injuries. And the workers there do amazing work with those folks. And it affects a lot of lives. And, you know, so it's, you know, that's really all I can say about it. It's just, there's a lot of great people out there that want to help. And gosh, if anybody I had an extra prayer in their prayer duffel bag, I mean, offer one up to maybe we can cure paralysis someday. Because it's really heartbreaking to see how a young person, any person's life, can change in a blink of an eye. And it would be great if they could ever come up with something to fix it. And but you know that's what we can hope for. But yeah, I'm just I'm just grateful for her, and I'm grateful for all the people who've kept her in their thoughts and prayers. And she's going to repay it to this world. Mm-hmm. Because she's going to do something great in this world. You watch.
Well, when I say this, you know I mean it from the heart. Jim Salisbury, you are one of a kind.
Thank you, buddy.
I have the utmost respect for you. I don't think I need to tell you that. I think you knew that. But I just wanted to put it out there that I have the utmost respect for you. I'm still praying for you and your family. And I can't thank you enough for taking this time to talk about baseball. Family, and hopefully I can get you on again before the year is over. I would love to have you on again to talk about whatever on the Gun on One podcast.
Maybe we'll talk about, you know, I have a smoker too, like you. After it. I do pork butt, I do turkey breast, I do wings, I do ribs. I do it all, bro.
You shouldn't have told me that, because now you definitely will be back on. We're going to talk barbecuing with Jim Salisbury. We're going to compare notes. You know, see, I don't like to give out too many secrets to people, because then people take your secrets and they use them for whatever, you know, but you know, every now and then it's okay to share. It's all right to share, you know, but Jim Salisbury, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it. Keep doing what you do, brother. And hopefully we can get some normalcy back in our lives in the sports world.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
All right, brother. And that's going to wrap up this latest edition of Gun on One, the podcast brought to you by Patterson Square Garden. As I tell you guys each and every week, continue to be blessed, but more importantly, extend yourselves and be a blessing to each and every person you encounter in your life. Until next time, so long, everybody. Of D-Gun Enterprises in Patterson Square Garden. Elvin Shabazian and Wes Pendleton are the executive producers on behalf of Patterson Square Garden. Lead producer is Derek Gunn. Associate producer is John McNeil. Sound design, mixing, and mastering by Elvin Shabazian. Original music by Weatherman. For more information about the podcast, visit gunonone.com. And please, don't forget to subscribe and give us a positive rating if you're feeling the show. Thank you.